Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Epic of Eight-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we have said several times that the Iraqi dictator Saddam's main goal of initiating the eight-year war and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. As a reminder, we discussed various characteristics of Basij volunteer forces which led to the victory of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the Holy Defense. Today we are going to continue the discussion. The operation for breaking the siege of Abadan, liberation of Khorramshahr, crossing the turbulent Arvand River in Valfajr 8 operation, and the consequent of Fav Peninsula were among the surprise operations that took place with the bravery of young Basiji forces. The long years of the war set the ground for Imam Khomeini to explicate and put into practice of the Islamic views on defense. Therefore, the Iranian nation became familiar with the culture of jihad and martyrdom. As a result, the Ba'athist enemy failed in achieving any of its goals of the war. During the eight-year war, the Iranian combatants launched nearly 100 small and great operations. The operational upper hand was in Iran's authority for approximately 6.5 years. Imam Khomeini said on this, "We are boastful that in this long and unequal battle, we have achieved victory only with reliance on the weapon of faith, trust in great God, the prayer of Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, self-confidence, and the endeavor of the brave men and women on the war front. And we thank God that we are not indebted to any power, country, or superpower. And our experienced people, with trust in God and seeking His help, have overcome many problems alone in terms of designing, operation, mobilization, and training of forces to the need for arms. And in addition to gaining miraculous successes in the scenes of defense of the Islamic country, pulling out the invaders from thousands of kilometers, we have achieved spectacular industrial developments such as launching of factories and changing the production lines, manufacturing and invention of scores of advanced and modern military devices, and that without the presence of any advisor or foreign helper. The 8-year imposed war caused myriads of problems for the Iranian people and the government. This caused the hidden talents of the young generation to flourish in various fields. Thus, with reliance on people's capabilities, Iran stood firmly against the enemies of humanity. Gradually, the Iranian nation turned into the producer of sophisticated equipment and arms. The war caused the military and defense industry to develop in the country, especially in the field of missile technology. In some period in the war, only half of Iran's military industry was active. Yet, Iran managed to administer the needs of the battlefield despite cruel sanctions that had been imposed by big powers, especially the great Satan, the US. With the relentless efforts of great and selfless martyrs like Hassan Shafizadeh and Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam, the ammunition for the artillery were gradually made, and this led to greater breakthroughs in the field of missile industry. Little by little, the Islamic Republic succeeded to indigenize Scud-B Tov missiles and make native missiles like Shahab-2 with 1,000 kilometers range. Then Iran entered other areas of defense technology and made coast-to-sea missiles. Moreover, the Islamic Republic succeeded to produce the fuselage of some helicopters like Cobra and 313 transportation aircraft. In later phases, Iran gained the know-how for manufacturing various parts of warplanes. Today, Iran is self-sufficient in over 90% of its military needs and defense industry, and is even able to export many items. Among the valuable achievements of the Holy Defense were the experiences that Iran gained in management, particularly in the field of designing, guidance, and execution of different operations. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, put it, the 8-year war has been an unending treasury. The war turned young combatants into great, experienced generals whose military designs dumbfounded top brasses in the world. Some of those brave youths attained martyrdom, while others lived to transfer their precious experiences to the next generations. No doubt, the most prominent feature of the Holy Defense was the unmatched leadership of Imam Khomeini as the commander-in-chief of the war. This was the greatest strong point of Iran. The Iranian people loved him deep in heart and were ready to sacrifice their life for him and his cause. The Imam was indeed the fulcrum of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. As it has been said in earlier episodes of this series, Imam Khomeini said in the beginning of the war that the war was a bounty for us. The war acted as an engine to awaken the dormant talents of the Iranian nation and turn it into an independent power. The Imam strongly believed in the Iranian people, and the people believed in his honesty, prudence, foresight, and wisdom. As Imam Khomeini was not afraid of anyone, he inspired this spirit among the Iranian people too. So, They believed in their capacities and made their utmost effort to turn the potentials into practice. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, gave the people the motive to pursue lofty goals without fearing the ruling powers. Dear listeners, next time you will hear the final episode of this series.
Around the world with reporters.
The Saudi atrocities against Yemeni children are endless. Hodeidah is one of the worst affected areas in Yemen. The children there suffer from life-threatening malnutrition. They are in dire need of assistance and medical treatment.
Hodeidah is the one who has been affected by Assad.
Hodeidah has a very high malnutrition burden for several reasons. The main reason is the aggression that has besieged the governorate and its coast, preventing fishermen from going to the sea and obtaining adequate food. Another reason is the rising unemployment. Here is the 3-year-old Saba struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit.
The 3-year-old Saba is struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit. The United Nations warned weeks ago that at least 98,000 Yemeni children were suffering from malnutrition at record high rates. However, despite the ongoing collapse of the health system in Yemen, there has yet been no international response.
There has been a noticeable increase in the number of malnutrition cases in the past 2 months. They exceed the hospital's capacity, where we only have 12 beds. We had to receive patients in other departments, such as the emergency department, and this affects the health of children and increases the number of deaths.
The health sector in Yemen has suffered a continuous deterioration amid the Saudi-led war in the country. Saudi-led coalitions of blockade has prevented the arrival of food and medicine to millions of Yemeni children and women. The Saudi-led coalition is not only targeting the Yemeni children with airstrikes, but also violates their most basic rights, such as access to food and medicine, in a clear breach of the international humanitarian law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Al-Hudaydah.
Iran's navy has unveiled the country's largest military vessel called Makran. It is a mobile base that can carry choppers and support the military frigates of the Iranian army's navy. This 228-meter auxiliary ship was in fact a trade ship, but the army changed it basically to turn into a floating port capable of carrying up to 82,000 tons of warship's needs. The support ship can also carry 5 helicopters and a battalion. It can travel for 1,000 days without having access to ports. Zereh was the other vessel unveiled by the Navy in the presence of top commanders.
The Iranian frigate called Zereh, or Armor, is an extremely useful vessel. It is very fast and powerful and can carry out its missions very well. It is equipped with advanced radars and electronic warfare facilities. Zereh can play a great role in safeguarding Iran's national interests. As the frigate is a totally indigenous one, it shows that our experts have successfully bypassed the sanctions.
Zereh is a missile-launching frigate of 47 meters length that can move at a speed of 35 nautical miles. It can launch cruise missiles up to 300 kilometers. After joining these two vessels, some sudden drills called Marine Power 99 were staged to check the readiness of the forces.
These drills were not on our agenda. The goal was to check the preparedness and quick reaction of our facilities and forces. Vessels, submarines, drones, coast-to-sea missiles were tested during this exercise, and they entered the mock danger zone extending over 600,000 kilometers.
The surface-to-surface cruise missiles, submarine and flight units of the Iranian Navy took part in the drills.
With these two vessels joining the Iranian Navy, the country's waters are safer than before, and a clear message is sent to Iran's enemies that they should never think of waging a war against the country. Human Abedi, Konarak.
As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we lack some information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccines, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil ministry has signed major investment agreements with domestic contractors in a bid to boost crude oil production. As part of the deals, the National Iranian South Oil Company and the Iranian Offshore Oil Company agreed to contract out major onshore projects in four oil-rich provinces, as well as offshore projects in the Persian Gulf, to domestic companies. The projects are worth $1.2 billion. Oil Minister Bijan Namdar Zangane says this is the last stage of a plan that aims to boost Iran's crude output by some 300,000 barrels a day.
We have pursued this plan since a few years ago, and today the 31st contract was signed. The agreements will ramp up the output by increasing the recovery factor of our oil fields. This is estimated to add about $1.5 billion annually to our total oil income.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. The country's oil production has almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day since U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal and reimposed unilateral oil embargoes on Iran 3 years ago. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels a day, down from 2.5 million. Zangane says Iran plans to increase its oil production by more than twofold next year, to 4.5 million barrels per day.
Due to the sanctions, the share of oil exports in our annual budget has slashed by 14%. But the restrictions have pushed us to discover new domestic capacities to keep the oil industry afloat. All of these contracts have been signed with Iranian contractors. Furthermore, over 70% of the needed equipment are manufactured indigenously. We are not going to relinquish our domestic capacities in the oil industry, even if the sanctions are lifted.
Last year, oil exports accounted for 35% of Iran's budget. Along with the U.S. sanctions, the coronavirus pandemic has also squeezed Iran's oil revenues by cutting global demand.
While Iran is poised to make a strong comeback to the oil market, Officials say crude revenues will cover only 25% of the country's next year budget, despite a projected rise in exports. This is Tehran is making a strategic shift to non-oil revenues to shield the economy from the ups and downs of its petroleum sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Leaders of Russia, Armenia and Azerbaijan set for talks in the Russian capital Moscow to discuss the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. The negotiations lasted about 4 hours, during which Russian President Vladimir Putin called for resolving issues connected with the peacekeeping operation as well as clarification of demarcation lines, humanitarian problems and protection of cultural heritage sites.
Today we can note with satisfaction that trilateral agreements are applied in practice. We believe that it creates necessary conditions for a full-fledged settlement of the old conflict on the just basis in the interest of both Azeri and Armenian nations.
Putin thanked Aliyev and Pashinyan for the fact that they positively perceived the active mediation actions of Russia aimed at stopping the bloodshed and stabilizing the situation. After 6 weeks of deadly fighting in and around Karabakh in September, Yerevan and Baku eventually agreed on November 9th to end hostilities under a Moscow broker deal that secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan in Karabakh and seven surrounding districts. The situation seems calm, with the exchange of prisoners and bodies of the dead carried out smoothly.
I believe that the key to success is to put an end to the presence of non-regional players such as France and the US. Experience shows that integration of regional players lead to great achievements. As we saw in the case of Syria, regional conflicts are resolved only when regional players sit for talks.
Following the trilateral talks in the Kremlin, the parties signed a joint statement on the development of Nagorno-Karabakh. To this end, it was decided that a plan be presented in the near future by the deputy prime ministers of Russia, Azerbaijan and Armenia.
2 months have passed since the ceasefire was signed. Our presence here shows that we are determined to fulfill the commitments made in September and November.
Unfortunately, today we couldn't resolve the issue of war prisoners. This is the most sensitive and painful issue. We agree to continue our cooperation in this area. We believe that the 8th paragraph of our joint statement has not yet been fully implemented. I hope we could make a concrete decision as soon as possible.
As part of the ceasefire, nearly 2,000 Russian peacekeepers have stationed along the Lachin Corridor in Azerbaijan, a 60 kilometers long route that links Khankendi to Armenia.
According to the Russian Ministry of Defense, by January 10th, over 48,000 refugees from Armenia returned to the region. The Russian department conducts round-the-clock monitoring of the situation and the ceasefire in the region. In addition, deepening work continues. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump's supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters, incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
But President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman, invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
...2021 will not be any better than the previous years for the health sector in Yemen. This was confirmed by Health Minister Taha al-Mutawakkil in a press conference in the capital Sana'a in response to questions regarding the future of the health situation in Yemen amid the war.
The suffering we are facing today is immense. The needs of the Yemeni people are huge and the infrastructure is poor. Then comes the aggression and the unjust blockade on Yemen, which contributed to the partial or total destruction of medical facilities. More than 315 medical facilities were destroyed by the aggression, including medical centers where international organizations were working. Medicines and medical equipment were also banned from entering the country.
The health minister expects 90% of medical equipment to be out of service in the upcoming weeks due to the end of their lifespan, the continuation of the blockade, and the oil derivatives crisis that has affected the power generation.
The international support provided to the Yemeni's health sector can only account for a maximum of 20% of the shortages in light of the spreading disease and the growing number of malnourished patients. All these are the result of the war and the siege imposed on Yemenis.
The health sector in Yemen has faced a tragic situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in March 2015, during which tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, were killed and millions of families were displaced.
Continued silence is still the position of the United Nations and international community towards the suffering of the people of Yemen, while the Saudi-led blockade has deprived them of most of their basic needs in life. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now the households of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
Yesterday, we presented the case to Iran's Shahid Beheshti Court for International Affairs. Of course, the case will demand that those culpable in the killing of the nuclear scientists face justice. Such a case is not unprecedented, since the U.S. has for several times taken a similar path against our government and froze our government's foreign assets.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but it is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's criminal agenda. If finalized, the case will lead to the seizure of $100 million of U.S. assets in foreign banks.
The legal action comes over a month after the assassination of top Iranian nuclear figure Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which, as in the previous incidents, Iran blames on Israel. Israel has a history of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth victim. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the killings, its footsteps can be tracked. In video recorded in 2018, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh
Head of Project Ahmad put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Coupled with the EU's lack of commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, the assassination of Fakhrizadeh made Iran change its policy with regards to its nuclear program. In response, the Islamic Republic officially announced that it resumed enriching uranium at 20% purity, markedly distancing from the 3.67% cap set by the nuclear deal.
The legal team here says the lawsuit against the U.S. pursues a single goal: to break the chain of its unlawful targeting of its key scientists. However, while the five slain scientists are viewed as the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry, officials say the sector is up and running. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The democratically controlled U.S. House of Representatives is expected to consider launch an impeachment process against the U.S. president on Wednesday. The Democratic lawmakers say they will move ahead with the measure if Vice President Mike Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment, an article that would immediately unseat the president if he is deemed unfit for office.
That's going to be very difficult to achieve, one, because I don't think Vice President Pence is inclined to do so, probably viewing it as political suicide for his future in case he wants to run for president in the future. So I don't think that one's likely. In the context of impeachment, it is a political process. And right now, I think the will is there by the Democratic Party, and it seems like even some Republicans may be interested.
So far, we've seen an unwillingness of Pence, in particular, to move forward with the 25th Amendment, and Trump, of course, is not taking responsibility or taking it upon himself to resign, as he has been called upon to do. So I'm not surprised that impeachment is likely to be the result.
Democrats and a few Republican lawmakers are calling for Trump's removal from office, citing his conduct and rhetoric. Experts say the lack of bipartisan balance in the calls, however, can put U.S. national security at risk.
I think there's certainly a risk of something atrocious happening. I hope, hearing that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, has been in contact with Pentagon officials, there may be some checks, but it does reveal somewhat of a danger in our process in terms of how powerful the executive is, and maybe we should think about that in the future.
The longer he remains in office, he still has access to all kinds of classified information and security codes. He has been isolating himself, which elevates the level of uncertainty about his actions in the coming days and weeks. I think there's definitely reason to be concerned about our overall security.
Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi underlined the urgency to remove Trump by speaking with Pentagon officials about safeguards of the president's access to the nuclear codes in the last days of his presidency. To make matters worse for Trump, the U.S. Department of Justice hasn't ruled out filing charges of insurrection, sedition, and attempted coup against him. Reporting from Miami, Rodney Corvello.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 32 of Surah Jathiyah.
وَإِذَا قِيلَ إِنَّ وَعْدَ اللَّهِ حَقٌّ وَالسَّاعَةُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهَا قُلْتُمْ مَا نَدْرِي مَا السَّاعَةُ إِنَّ ظُنُّ إِلَّا ظَنَّا وَمَا نَحْنُ بِمُسْتَيْقِنِينَ
And when it was said, Allah's promise is indeed true, and there is no doubt about the hour, you said, We do not know what the hour is. We know nothing beyond conjectures, and we do not possess any certainty. Remember, in our last Friday's episode of this series, while explaining the previous ayah of this surah, we said that despite the earnest endeavors of the prophets, the imams, the saints, the scholars, and the righteous persons, the intransigent sinners, idol worshippers, atheists, and all other disbelievers refused to heed the words of guidance and persisted in their evil ways until death overcame them. As a result, they will be engulfed in torment and punishment on the day of resurrection, which they use to deny with disdain and self-conceit, which means the all-merciful Lord never wrongs anyone. And it is only the sinners and disbelievers who wrong themselves by indulging in evil, despite the ample opportunities for repentance and reform provided by God. The ayah that we recited to you now means to say that the characteristics of the disbelievers include suspicion, while those of the believers include inquiry, follow-up, and attainment of certitude. On the day of resurrection, disbelievers shall be engulfed by the evil consequences of their evil deeds. Because whenever the true believers would remind them of the truth of God's promise and the eventuality of the day of judgment, instead of contemplating, they used to dismiss it as a conjecture. They would say with disdain, What is that? We do not know what the hour is. In other words, if these very disbelievers are told that their house is exposed to fire or flood, they will instantly react and make preparations to avert such a probable danger. But when they are reminded of the day of resurrection and judgment, they do not consider any likelihood for its occurrence. From this ayah, we learn that, number one, the true believers should convey the words of truth to all, so that the argument is sealed and no one has any excuses in this regard. And number two, for the conscientious, even the mention of the day of resurrection is enough to prevent them from committing sins. Let us now listen to Ayah 33 of the same surah.
وَبَدَا لَهُمْ سَيِّئَاتُ مَا عَمِلُوا وَحَاقَ بِهِمْ مَا كَانُوا بِهِ يَسْتَهْزِئُونَ
The evils of what they had done will appear to them, and they will be besieged by what they used to deride. This ayah says that On the day of resurrection, the disbelievers will be handed the record of their deeds and will not be able to deny anything. Their evil deeds shall be made manifest for them on the day of judgment, and they will realize what they used to ridicule has finally engulfed them, and there is no escape from its consequences. From this ayah, we learn the following points. Number one, on the day of resurrection, all our deeds will become manifest for us along with their consequences. And number two, those who mock divine rules and teachings of the prophets will one day face the consequences of their arrogant and evil behavior. Now let us listen to Ayah 34 of Surah Jathiyah.
وقيل اليوم ننساكم كما نسيتم لقاء يومكم هذا ومأواكم النار وما لكم من ناصرين.
And it will be said, today we will forget you, just as you forgot the encounter of this day of yours. The fire will be your abode, and you will not have any helpers. According to Qur'ani teachings, forgetfulness resulting from the weak memory of a person is neither a crime nor a sin, therefore not punishable. But if a person feigns forgetfulness or does not pay attention to God's commandments out of arrogance and disdain for divine rules, he or she deserves punishment. For example, some persons deny the occurrence of the day of resurrection and insist upon the wrong belief, while some others, even if they do not deny it, are heedless of it in their daily life and act in a way as if they have forgotten it. Both groups will be punished in proportionate with their deeds, and on the day of resurrection, God will treat them as if He had forgotten them. In other words, they have deprived themselves of divine mercy, and as a result will be cast into hell with no helper to save them. Afflicted by torment, the disbelievers shall be told by the angels in charge of their tormenting that the prophets and their teachings were meant to remind you of the eventuality of such a day, but you used to ridicule their words of guidance. As a result, now you have to bear the consequence of your sins, being left to taste the everlasting torment in hell, without any helper to rescue you. This ayah teaches us that, number one, anyone who ignores the eventuality of the day of resurrection through negligence of divine commandments or feigning forgetfulness out of arrogance will be left to his or her fate in the fires of hell, as if forgotten. And number two, mere belief is not enough and should be coupled with virtuous deeds, since a true believer is always conscious of the day of resurrection and judgment. Now let us listen to Ayah 35 of the same surah.
ذَلِكُمْ بِأَنَّكُمُ اتَّخَذْتُمْ آيَاتِ اللَّهِ هُزُوًا وَغَرَّتْكُمُ الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا فَالْيَوْمَ لَا يُخْرَجُونَ مِنْهَا وَلَا هُمْ يُسْتَعْتَبُونَ.
That is because you took the signs of God in derision, and the life of the world had deceived you. So today, they will not be brought out of it, that is hell, nor will they be asked to placate Allah. This ayah means to say, persons engrossed in material pursuits and deceived by the pleasures or sorrows of mundane life begin to deride truth and realities, as well as the eventuality of the day of resurrection. As a result, they shall plunge in hell, from whose torments they will not find deliverance, nor will be able to justify their excuses for ridiculing divine signs. The disbelievers are thus warned that this is the recompense for the deeds for mocking at the eventuality of the judgment day and the punishment for the sinners, for turning away from the guidance of the prophets with such absurd phrases as, "Who knows of the hereafter? Where is hell? Where is paradise?" This ayah teaches us that, number one, eternal misery in the hereafter is the result of being engrossed in material pursuits and deceived by mundane life. And number two, through the prophets, God Almighty has sealed all argument for mankind so that nobody will be able to raise any excuse on the Day of Judgment. Now we present you ayahs 36 and 37, which mark the end of Surah Jathiyah.
فلله الحمد رب السماوات ورب الأرض رب العالمين وله الكبرياء في السماوات والأرض وهو العزيز الحكيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
So all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of the heavens and the Lord of the earth, the Lord of all the worlds. To him belongs all supremacy in the heavens and the earth, and he is the Almighty, the All-Wise. These ayahs mean to say that all praise is for the one and only creator of the entire universe and whatever it contains of the heavens, the earth, the innumerable planets, the plants, the animals, the birds, the inanimate things, as well as souls and bodies. Allah Almighty thus has majesty and supremacy over everything in the universe, which the omnipotent sovereign has arranged with perfect order in harmony with the rule of nature, based on infinite wisdom. This means we human beings are duty-bound to develop his cognizance in the proper manner and express gratitude for his innumerable bounties. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, he who has created the universe, including the earth and its wonders of nature, deserves the highest praise. Number two, the entire creation reflects the majesty, power, and wisdom of the one and only Creator. And number three, the proper cognition of God prevents us from disbelief and sins and leads to obedience and the correct form of worship. Well, dear listeners, inshallah, next week we will take up explanation of the next surah in the serial order, that is Ahqaf. God bless you and goodbye.
Iran Today.
International law remains in want of U.S. commitment. But with a new U.S. president waiting in the wings to take over from outgoing President Trump, the country may return to respecting deals it's made. With regard to Iran, that may be a half-hearted, partial return to the JCPOA and commitments thereof. But globally, hopes remain high. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal, is not all that's turned sour between the U.S. and Iran. So getting it back on track may not mean fruitful talks or any talks between the two countries, but it is a start. A good starting point would be to count the number of commitments the U.S. disregarded by pulling out of the deal so that we can then count back
and see what commitments President-elect Joe Biden will have to recommit to. What Iran expects before getting into talks with America is that it respect its sovereignty and independence. Independence of the U.S. may be relative, but on a national level, Iran refuses to turn coat and color like so many regional states, just to align itself with the American compass. Its slogan in the field of revolutionary foreign policy remains dignity, wisdom, and expediency. Mr. Amouyi is on the Parliamentary Security Committee. I asked, with all the distrust instilled in Iran, is it not the U.S. that holds the key to opening up relations? Should Biden's USA re-enter the JCPOA without any bargaining, would you say that this would solve any problems between Iran and America?
We once had the experience of reaching a common path with them on the nuclear issue, but they did not do well in following through this path. All these experiences and all these histories show us that we cannot expect problems to be solved so soon. That is, in fact, as long as U.S. policies are regulated in such a way that is in the interest of the Zionist regime in the region, do not recognize the sovereignty of the countries in the region, or intend to interfere in our internal affairs and neighboring countries. One cannot expect that problems between Iran and the U.S. will be solved.
Perhaps re-entering the JCPOA or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action can be a sign of America's good faith and respect for its Iranian partners' interests. Joe Biden has said he will re-enter the deal, which would mean again lifting economic sanctions off Iran. There is a condition that Iran step back into full commitment to the deal. Now, Iran only started stepping out reversibly in response to Donald Trump's backing out of the deal altogether. So no problem there. Iran will recommit. However, it will not renegotiate the deal. And it expects compensation for its economic losses following the U.S. pullout from the deal.
The nuclear deal is about the nuclear issues. It is not about other issues such as Iranian ballistic missiles or the role of Iran in the Middle East, like the issue of Palestine, Israel, or Iran's support for Hezbollah and Hamas. The nuclear deal was just about the nuclear deal. And in fact, this logic, this philosophy helps to settle to an agreement. If we discuss a lot of issues in certain negotiations, it is very clear that we won't come to a clear, a tangible conclusion. But when there is a framework, when there is clear issue, like the nuclear issue, it makes the negotiations possible to come to a conclusion. So Iran does not want to expand the negotiations on other issues, because they will fail the negotiations.
Also, there remains a shady spot even in the scenario of all going smoothly. Would a U.S. return to the JCPOA be wholly good for Iran?
First, we are familiar with the history of Biden and his team. Unfortunately, they are the closest democratic politicians to the Zionist regime, whose opposition to us is obvious. Biden himself and his advisors also had positions that we think are very negative. We should refer to Biden's article on CNN, where he explains that he is the one who knows the smarter ways to put pressure on Iran. In fact, his principle of pressuring Iran is the same as that of Trump's team.
What were the commitments that the Americans violated?
The Americans have generally had the obligation to end sanctions against Iran in return for restricting our nuclear program and to allow Iran access to their market, especially on issues such as copper trade. We also made purchases amongst items that Americans could provide resources for. For example, attempts were made at the time to buy American airplanes, but unfortunately, the Americans did not fulfill any of these obligations after leaving the JCPOA.
As a test of how predictably rosy things might or might not get for Iran if the U.S. returns to the deal, let's go just as far back as its former administration when President Obama himself inked the JCPOA with Iran. To what extent did U.S. and Western commitment to the deal materialize at the time when Joe Biden was vice president? Mr. Hanizadeh is a political analyst who shared his views on Skype.
In fact, the United States inflicted the most damage to this international agreement among the countries that signed the accord. The United States had serious obligations under the JCPOA, one of which was releasing Iran's frozen assets, but that did not happen. Of course, during the tenure of former U.S. President Barack Obama, some of these assets were released, but this was a small amount. In fact, with the arrival of Donald Trump and his withdrawal from the JCPOA, a series of challenges arose, including the fact that Donald Trump imposed harsh sanctions against the Iranian nation, and these crippling sanctions caused damage to the structure of the Iranian economy.
Iran wasted no time in inking agreements with major aircraft manufacturers such as Boeing and Airbus when the nuclear deal was signed under Barack Obama. But by the time Trump pulled out of the deal 2 years later in 2018, Boeing had not delivered any of its aircraft and Airbus delivered 3 out of 98 ordered. Iran's fleet is 60 years old, and with sanctions in place, it cannot even acquire spare parts. Result? Of the 5 major fatal plane crashes in 2018, one was in Iran. 66 people were killed in February when an Asaman Airlines plane crashed an hour outside Tehran. How much commitment to the nuclear deal did the U.S. show, even in the time of President Obama?
The fact is that the breach of U.S. commitments began during the Obama administration. We saw several examples at the same time. The Iran Sanctions Act was ratified in the Obama era. One of the tools that Obama used to put pressure on the Iranian economy was a subsequent extension of sanctions, which in fact conditioned our economy. As a result, the investors that were active in Iran were constantly waiting for 3 or 4 months or 90 or 120 days or another 180 days to see whether the sanctions will be suspended or not. Well, those were the tools that were activated during Obama's time. We have not seen a good precedent of Democrats fulfilling their commitments. Contrary to popular belief, it was the Democrats themselves who took the non-commitment path before Donald Trump took office.
I asked what fields Iran had suffered in most as a result of sanctions, which have led to a sharp currency devaluation and high inflation.
The U.S. imposed inhumane sanctions, especially on medical equipment, and refused to deliver a large amount of medicine it owed to Iran. Also, part of Iran's oil revenues that were frozen by the U.S. and other countries, including South Korea, India, and Japan, together with its added value, must be returned to Iran. If the U.S. wants to engage in new negotiations with Iran, it needs to compensate Tehran and pay the added value of the frozen assets.
Skilled pilots have at times saved passengers in spite of rickety planes. More than 100 passengers and crew were saved in 2012 when the pilot Hushang Shahbazi landed a commercial airplane with a disabled wheel carriage. He did so using only landing gear under the wings. But you can't always beat the odds when sanctions are not the occasional odd occurrence. And that is why Biden is under scrutiny as to whether he will re-enter the nuclear deal as smoothly as he says he will. Because it is that nuclear deal that was supposed to lift UN economic nuclear-related sanctions off Iran, in return for this country limiting its peaceful nuclear program. Iran close to choked its program, but got close to nothing out of doing so. And come 2018, Donald Trump pulled out of the deal altogether and reimposed and reinforced UN sanctions as US sanctions. The nuclear deal, or JCPOA, was signed between Iran on one side and the P5+1 on the other. The P5+1s, the permanent UN Security